Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to an Empire Podcast interview special. Now this might become a regular thing through the year, folks, and we have an absolutely belting lineup for this one. First up, this week sees the release of No Other Choice, the latest film from the incredible South Korean director Park Chan-wook, director of Oldboy, Stoker, The Handmaiden, and many, many more. Based on a novel by Donald Westlake, it's a dark tale starring Lee Byung-hun as a man whose job and way of life is threatened, and he responds with an unusual plan. He decides to bump off all his rivals for a job. Pitch Black and Pitch Perfect, we gave it 5 stars. That's right, 5 stars. And in this interview, Amon Warman sits down with director Park and Lee Byung-hun, seen in the likes, of course, of I Saw the Devil, The Magnificent Seven, Squid Game, and who last worked with director Park on his 2000 movie Joint Security Area for a lovely translator-assisted chat about the movie. I usually say enjoy at this point, but frankly, you have no other choice.
Would like to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the director and co-writer of No Other Choice, Park Chan-wook, and its star, Lee Byung-hun. Welcome to you both. How are you?
Thank you.
Good.
Good? Park, I'm going to start with you. This is a passion project that's been 20 years in the making. How close is the final movie to what you had originally envisioned?
예, 처음 책을 읽은 지가 20년이고요. 실제
So it's been 20 years since I first read the book, and only 16 years since I started working on the adaptation. And the version I initially thought of is very different from the version we have today, primarily because I had envisioned it originally as an American film. And only recently did I come up with the idea to turn this into a Korean film, which seems like an easy idea, but it took so long for me to come up with it. And of course, the biggest difference for me for it to be a Korean film is to be able to cast amazing Korean actors like Byung-hun who's sitting next to me.
I actually wanted to ask you as well, you were a film critic before you became a filmmaker. What impact has that background had on the art that you produce, if any?
Yeah, 사실은 감독이 먼저였고요.
So I was a director at first, but because my films failed tremendously, that's why I was forced to work as a film critic.
그래서 억지로 하는 일이었기 때문에 그래도 좀 정신승리하기
위해서. I forced it to it, so I tried to view it in a positive light by telling myself that analyzing and viewing other people's films in great detail will be helpful for later when I'm creating my own films. But I was completely wrong. It wasn't helpful at all.
Fair enough. Lee, this movie is adapted from Donald Westlake's novel, The Axe. And I know that there was also a previous movie adaptation of this story. Did you feel a need to seek out and revisit either of those to the takes on this story, or were you happy to rely on the script that Park and others co-wrote?
No Other Choice도 그렇지만, 원작이 있는 경우에.
It's the same with No Other Choice as how I approach the other works that I do. When there's an original source or it's a remake of another film, I typically ask the director, should I look at the original as a way of reference? Would that be helpful? So with this film, I of course asked Director Park, would it be helpful if I read the original novel or watched a prior film? And he said, well, actually, it's going to be quite a different film. It's going to be set in Korea, be culturally very different, so probably better not that you don't consume those works. So I solely focused on the script that Director Park gave me, which I analyzed and studied.
I read that after you initially read the script, you were wondering if it was meant to be as funny as it read to you. Is that true? And why is that?
저는 읽으면서 처음
As I was reading the script, I really laughed a lot. And is it really Director Park's intention to be so funny? So I did ask him in order to double check.
Yeah. For you, Park, when you're directing these actors in these funny scenes, is it funnier to you and indeed to us as an audience if the actors play funny scenes dramatically straight?
Yeah, 한국 영화 그 매력, 한국도 드라마의 매력.
When people mention the reason behind the success of Korean media, I think the response is usually that there are different emotions and different genres that are mixed within them. And Korean media freely moves in between these different emotions and genres. So there was no hesitation in an approach where a comedy or tragedy is mixed in the moments across the film. But in regards to performance or when I'm directing them as a director, I think an attitude that I wanted to avoid is to explicitly tell the audience that, oh, this is supposed to be funny. Because I think true humor really comes through when you are faithful and truthful to the character. And especially in regards to the movie, the comedy is always paired with sympathy here.
I want to talk to you a little bit more about the funny aspect of this, because this did have me laughing quite a bit. Is there anyone either of you go to as an indicator, oh, that the laughter, that the humor is working? Like, if this person, if I can get this person to laugh, either on set or in the script level, I know that I'm doing something right here. Or are you more reliant on you as just a writer, director? You know what's funny to you, and that's all that matters.
It would have been nice to have someone like that. I used to actually have an assistant director in the past who rarely ever laughed at anything. So if he laughed, I would know that this is actually supposed to be funny. But since I don't have him anymore, I just ask anyone that I can grab, my DP, my production designer, my actors, my producers, and ask them if this is actually funny to them.
Lee, is there anyone that you were proud of getting to maybe laugh on set? And do you sort of have to hold yourself back from laughing at the ridiculous nature of some of what your character gets up to here?
많았어요. 이 촬영을 하면서.
There were many. There were so many moments that were funny and comical. However, I was very cautious when making the film that the intention to be funny wasn't too excessive when it came to making my movements or the emotions that I was portraying, so that it wouldn't interfere with the audience's emotions. That when I was acting, I was only faithful to the emotions that Manzo was going through. For Manzo, this is an incredibly desperate situation. It's a very sorrowful fight that he's fighting. Mm-hmm. For the audience, objectively looking from far away, it can look very comical and ridiculous for them. However, for him, it was a very tough war that he was battling.
근데 개인적으로 이제 연기가 끝나고 모니터를 보면서 제일 많이 며칠 동안이나 웃었던 장면이
Personally,
있어요.
After I finished acting, when looking at the monitor, there was one scene that had me laughing for days every time that I would review it. And it's a scene where he's screaming with Adder and he's in the car and in fright and looking at the side mirror and making all these ridiculous noises, imagining, wow, what did it really feel like that if you're trying to run away from someone holding a gun?
Yeah. Yeah, that scene is hilarious. There's so many scenes which are hilarious. Park wanted to ask you about collaborating with this gentleman. It's your first collaboration in 20 years, but I know that you guys have remained very good friends and see each other often. Has he still managed to surprise you? You know, you've known him very well, but when he's acting out this character, this film on set, does he still manage to surprise you? And what about this performance really impressed you in that regard?
그동안 이제 뭐 친하게 지내기도 했고 그의 출연작들을 다 봤기 때문에
As you've mentioned, we've stayed very close throughout the years and I've watched every project that he starred in. So I was very aware of the talent he has and how that's further evolved over the years. But something that did surprise me during the shoot is that he is a man of so many expressions. I wondered to myself, how can one person have that many expressions? So I was very much surprised by that. And that also means that this is an actor who is good at coming up with reactions to all sorts of different situations. He has no hesitation like, oh, can I react this way in that situation or that way in this situation? He freely just performs with whatever ideas he comes up with. And I think this is only possible because he's worked across so many different genres with so many different directors.
Lee, how has Park changed in how he directs you over the years, I guess, since the last collaboration? Does there even need to be much that he needs to say? Or do you just understand because he got that shorthand with him now, having worked with him before, but also having been close friends over the years?
예전에 이제 JSA를 할 때도 그렇지만
It was the same with JSA in the past as now. Always on set, he has this very serene smile. He's very respected by many people. So in that sense, he hasn't changed at all. However, with the other actors now or all the other department staff, he makes these incredibly sharp, precise requests that are very detailed and increasingly becomes detailed as this continues. So wondering, wow, the burden of being a master on his shoulders, is that making him even more of a perfectionist? He really was before, but even more so now. So he's become increasingly more detailed and meticulous in how he's directing. And at times when he wears this very serene smile, but continues to make these increasingly sharp requests, I think, wow, that's probably more evil.
Amazing. More than just being the title of the film, No Other Choice is a mantra that your character and other characters repeat to themselves over and over and over again. Do you, as a filmmaker and as an actor, have any mantras that you like to repeat to yourself, either on set or in life?
매 촬영장마다 그런 얘기를 많이 하지만 이번 촬영에 더 많이 했던
For me, it's something that I say to myself on set, on every set, but I think I said it way more on this set. So compared to other directors, as mentioned, Director Park really has more requests than anyone else. So on the inside, I'll be thinking, I think I did a pretty good job, but you're making this other request. Okay, fine, then I'll give it a try. I'll try it once. I don't know if it's going to work or not, but yeah, I'll give it a go.
저는 정말 No Other Choice가 그 제목으로 정해진 이유가
I think the reason I titled the film No Other Choice is because I realized myself that I use that statement a lot in moments of self-justification or at moments of resignation. So after I've become conscious of just how often I use that statement, I've realized that I need to title the film this way.
I just quickly wanted to ask about the one of the best needle drops of the year for me, which is Red Dragonfly by Cho Young Pil. Why was that the track that you went with? Loved the track. And for you, Lee, what was it like for you filming that scene? Can you even hear the other actor that you're sharing the scene with saying those lines as you're shouting them? Just an incredible scene.
저는 저희는 촬영장에서 그 노래를 틀지 않고 했어요.
For us, we didn't actually play the song while we were acting at the time. We just were told that this song would be playing very loudly in the background, so it's something that we imagined.
예, 저는 그 영화, 그 노래가,
I think the first reason is because I wanted to make the song more well-known to foreign and younger audiences because I really love the song. And another reason is that red dragonflies represent fall in Korea. So along with the gecko trees, I wanted a symbolism for fall. And on top of that, the song is just so absurdly not fitting with the situation that's playing on the screen, which was why I chose the song on purpose.
It's an awesome scene. It's an awesome film. Loved it so much. Congratulations. Park, Lee, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, that was Park Chan-wook and Lee Byung-hun talking to Amon Worman about No Other Choice, which is in cinemas as of today. Also debut in cinemas today, that's Friday, January 23rd, is Saipan, a movie from Northern Irish directing duo Glenn Leyburn and Lisa Barros de Sá, which tells the true life story behind the Republic of Ireland's tumultuous World Cup campaign in 2002, when their captain Roy Keane fell out with their manager Mick McCarthy just before the tournament began and walked out famously telling McCarthy to stick it up your bollocks, which sounds painful and is also logistically difficult. Ireland were eliminated in the round of 16 on penalties, a heroic effort without the talismanic captain, and we'll never know how well they might have done with him. It was a story that made worldwide headlines at the time and was a particularly big deal in Ireland, of course, and Saipan makes for interesting viewing as it tries to paint both men's sides of the story. Starring as Keane and McCarthy are Aina Hardwick, an Irish actor who hails from Keane's own home city of Cork, and Steve Coogan, who may be from Manchester, where of course Keane was playing at the time for United, but has deep Irish roots. And this conversation that I had with the pair of them gets pretty deep about Ireland and Ireland's place in the world at times. Oh, and it was taking place last year at around the time of another fairly high profile falling out in football between Liverpool's Mo Salah and their manager Arne Slot. So that's where I began. Had a lot of fun with this one. Very educational and informative. And I hope you enjoy it as well. Enjoy. You have no other choice again.
Steve, Aina, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you both?
Very well, thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you. Excellent. This is a hell of a time to be talking about this movie, which is obviously about Roy Keane and Mick McCarthy's legendary falling out in 2002, because it's kind of happening right now. I don't know how closely you guys follow football. This will be out in January, so it might have resolved itself by then. But Mo Salah, my idol, has currently fallen out with the Liverpool manager, very publicly. And that's kind of wild. Is it, you know, nice bit of timing? You've been following that at all, either of you?
I haven't.
Yeah.
No, I've been keeping an eye. It's more sort of, I've been keeping an eye on it because I'm not, I'm a Villa fan, but I really think Mo Salah is incredible and I really like him. And I don't understand the inner workings of football dressing rooms, but I've just been reading a little bit about it.
Okay.
And yeah, it does have a bit of the 2002, it has remnants of that, definitely.
It has. I don't think Mo's told Arne Slot to stick it up his bollocks just yet, but it feels like we're on the precipice.
I hope he has it close to hand, because it's a good it's a good one to have.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, so, Steve, you haven't been following, you're a football fan to an extent, no. Steve. Oh, that's right, you follow Man United. So,
I teed that up perfectly for you.
You better
enjoy that one. Annoyed about that, actually.
Well, I do what I can. I do what I can. But this is a fascinating film because I'm from the north, but I remember exactly where I was when the news broke that Roy had walked out on the World Cup preparations. I was in my sister's kitchen. I don't know if this is something, do you remember where you were when this happened? Was this a big thing for you?
I mean, I remember it all happening. I remember the bus stop and seeing it on the news and everything. But it wasn't big enough for me to remember where I was. No, I was probably in the kitchen watching the TV going, oh, right, so he's walked out. Oh, that's a bit serious, isn't it?
But I know I was five.
Do remember. I probably remember the mythology of it more. Like I remember the sticker books of that World Cup. I remember all the kind of like the imagery of that World Cup. And then I remember watching Brazil win it. And I remember not really knowing, because there was so much excitement about Ireland, and then not really knowing why it petered out. I knew something had happened, but didn't know what it was. And then probably more formative memories of all of the like the après matches and the gift grubs and all the kind of satire, actually, that it gave rise to for years. There was a good 4 years where it felt like every sort of comedy skit and impressionist in Ireland was all about the Mick and Roy dynamic. And I loved, you know, gift grub, après match, all that growing up. And that was my Christmas present. I was, you know, I'd get the DVDs and the CDs.
Really?
Yeah. And I remember it was so much of it was about the Irish football team.
Yeah. It was so rich, fertile ground.
It was. It really milked it for years, you know.
They absolutely did.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, to make a movie about it is really, really fascinating, to really get a dig into the minutiae of exactly what happened and paint both sides, I think, fairly equally as well. I know that was important to you, Steve, that maybe when the script first came your way, it was more Roy-centric.
Yeah, yes. I thought it was fairly balanced, but I just thought it just, you know, if you'd appraise that, I thought it was a bit sort of 60-40 Roy, and I thought it should be more even than that. I mean, to me, it was just a very interesting discussion about about Ireland and Irish identity, and that's what if it had just been about an argument in the world of football, I wouldn't have been interested in doing the movie.
Was there something the appeal as well of the fact that Mick McCarthy, yes, he played for Ireland, but he's very much a dour Yorkshireman? And was there a sense of, even though Jack Charlton is, I guess, the greatest Irish manager of all time, that it was maybe a little bit of resistance to Mick? Was that something that you...
Well, yeah, I mean, it was more just to do with the idea of there's still the idea that, although Mick was second generation, that this, and you could also argue about Jack Charlton is like bringing in a British guy to sort out the Irish fellas.
Yeah.
This, even though is that there's still an element of that, which can, unless you're fully Irish, can be prickly, depending on how you treat it. That, but all that very complex idea of how you treat the world and how you see the world and what your identity is as a human being and as a sort of a person of that has a national identity as well, a cultural national identity. All that stuff to me was what was interesting about it, because it made it transcend just the idea of a discussion about a thing that happened in football. Yeah.
Just a scuffle in a way. But Aina, was it the same for you? I mean, you're not just playing this Irish national hero, but you're playing a local hero for you.
Yeah.
You're from Cork.
Yeah, it was that all the same reasons as Steve said there. Like I was interested in it, the prospect of that film. I thought, like, what'll that be? I found it a hard thing to picture in a way. And then I read the script and I met Glenn and Lisa, and I was really like taken with both the script itself and their vision for it, because I think it got underneath things in different levels, on the kind of national identity level, in the kind of the psyche of these two men. And also some kind of nuanced stuff that isn't usually like fertile ground for storytelling on film. Things like, as you said, the complexity of national identity and where that sits in Ireland, I think has always fascinated me, because I was really interested in the idea of how we see ourselves as a country, as a sort of post-colonial island of 4 million people. Like where do we pitch ourselves? Do we see ourselves as being able to compete on the world stage? And do we see ourselves as I think at one point it's called the Cabaret Act by Jeremy Paxman in an interview that's featured in the film. And I found that touched a nerve. Like I really understood that. And that's a broad level, but on a micro level, I understood that in my own life. Cause I always think, I've always felt that push pull between wanting to sort of please people and wanting to sort of be a kind of the likable Irish, and then maybe being a bit more forthright or fun-footed in what you kind of believe in and in your own sort of convictions. And I think the fact that we're making this film now in 2024, 2025 feels really right, because I look at the kind of Irish cultural output now, or whether it's our sporting teams, but especially our like musicians and writers, and there does seem to be this kind of conviction and forthrightness and this sense of ownership over one's kind of views and whether that's political or whether that's in your art. And that I find really exciting. And I think this film in a way kind of looks at that. It looks at that in a very oblique way.
Yeah. It's really interesting actually, because once upon a time, like 50 years ago, it was the church really was the people that sort of governed the idea of what Ireland was, the Republic.
Absolutely.
The church and to some extent, you know, the nationalist politicians. But the cultural output in the last 40 years and where we are now, where it's it's sort of gone beyond Irishness. There are lots of brilliant Irish creative people who happen to be from Ireland, who like made this big contribution globally to the sort of to popular culture all around the world that transcends its Irishness in a way, although that's part of it. Whether it's actors, writers, musicians, it's now sort of in some ways culturally, you know, it's punches well above its weight as a country globally. But that wasn't always the case. And it's interesting because this is 25 years ago now, Saipan. And it's interesting because it's almost like feels like it's a bit of a crossroads where Ireland started to become, if you like, owned by younger people, or the young people of Ireland had a much bigger voice. Certainly, you know, it felt like once upon a time, Ireland was run by old people. It feels like that to me, like 50 years ago, that it was run by, and now it feels
very
like
very set in their ways, people. Yeah,
it's much more modern and outward looking.
And so much of our great storytelling in that period that you're talking about, I think, was about people being under the yoke of a Catholic doctrine or a quite a conservative country. I'm talking in very broad strokes, of obviously, course, yeah. But whereas there's something different now, I think there's something quite. I think there's something very
predates. Also, the celebration of the Irish culture, I feel like predates religion. It's like going back to something before that.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
Something more elemental and primeval that predates the arrival of Christianity.
Well, the Catholic doctrinaire kind of stuff only really came in the 20s with the foundation of the state. I'm probably going on a tangent here, but
I love tangents.
Doing play by the Western world at the moment, international, and like that is the heart of what we've been talking about in the play, is that like trying to almost unlearn a version of Ireland in the turn of the 20th century, in around 1900, trying to unlearn a version that we think we know and relearn a version that was before the Catholic Church kind of took hold of the bureaucracy of the country and the administration of it, and trying to imagine this time before that, where actually there was this really surprising, eclectic, kind of unusual folk traditions practices and way of life, especially in the west of Ireland. I mean, we're talking about Mayo, which is Steve's neck of the woods. And it's really exciting to rediscover all that. And I think there's something of our cultural output now that is rediscovering that.
Yes, I'd say so. Yeah, yeah. It's quite exciting because certainly I think the church became, because of historically, it was the church was by nature of being anti-establishment church that was in England, and therefore the colonial, that being Catholic was almost like a position of colonial opposition.
Yes, exactly.
And that's why it sort of was adopted wholesale as just an act of defiance almost. But then you sort of lumbered with all the rubbish that goes with it. So it's a bit like running into wine.
Well, these conversations you guys had on set after the first week, because I know that you were a little bit not standoffish about Steve after the first week.
I was sort of. I won't embarrass Steve. I will a little bit. I'm a huge fan. Have been for a long time, since I wanted to be an actor, really. And I think I probably did that thing where I didn't want to come across that way. So I said, it's better to come across, we're going to be equals and we're going to meet each other head on, and I'm not going to be sort of kind of fanboying or whatever. I probably went the other side of that extreme, which is to kind of fold around. All right. Okay.
I was a bit anxious at the start because I thought, I thought Aina's obviously going to be doing his thing, whatever it is, to get to Roy Keane. And knowing what I know about Roy Keane, that might involve him not wanting to be busy mates with the guys playing Mick McCarthy. Yeah. There's a certain, that makes sense to a certain extent. So I sort of gave him a bit of room, I didn't come up and put my arm around him and go, great, all right, mate, we're going to have a right old laugh doing this, aren't we? Didn't do any of that. But then I sort of walked to him, I think we sort of started chatting, saying, you're all right, is everything okay, because I sort of wanted to, sometimes if you do the old pals act, it cannot be helpful to what you're doing on screen. So
it's funny, isn't it?
But I did, obviously, we did have nice chats, but we were always really nice to each other. I was aware of because I've been around longer, sometimes people give you deference because of that. And I don't want that to cramp his style in whatever he was doing to get to Roy. You know what I mean? So you sort of you've got to be not make any assumptions.
It's a funny thing because you're so intuiting it on the day, because you just arrive 5 days before filming, or if you're lucky, and then start doing the thing, and it's such a kind of weird thing to do. But it was never in a method way, never in a conceived way where you're like, oh no, I'm not going to talk. We had a great time. It's more comes out of kind of nerves and wanting to make the film the best film you can with the tiny time. You only get 5 weeks or whatever to make these films. And it was that thing of kind of controlling your nerves by going, I'm just gonna really stay in my lane and focus on my thing. And then after a week or two, you loosen up and you realize you can do both. Yes. That it's not a literal thing. You don't need to preserve some kind of But it was just a way of dealing with the nerves.
Amazing. And really now you have long chats about Ireland as well. But guys, I'm going to let you go.
Good to see you, Aina,
Steve. Yeah, it's been amazing. It's been a history lesson and everything. It's been fantastic. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks.
Cheers.
Well, that was Steve Coogan and Aina Hardwick talking about Saipan, which is out in UK cinemas from today, Friday, January 23rd. It's been out in Ireland for a couple of weeks already. Really, really fascinating interview. I was very, very happy to sit back and listen to them as well. Oh, and listeners may be delighted to know that Mo Salah and Arne Slot seem to have patched up their differences, at least for the time being. And on that note, that is it for this interview special, the regular podcast, the regular Empire podcast, also featuring interviews this week with Chris Pratt and Claire Foy, is out now as well. So please do listen to that and keep them peeled for more specials coming your way. Thank you so much for listening. Do not stick it up your bollocks. Bye-bye.